Welcome back. Welcome back to our RNN workshop. Our last speaker is Nal Kalkbrenner from DeepMind. Again, some ideas from DeepMind. Nal is well known for his contribution to sequence-to-sequence learning, and very recently for the Pixel RNN, perhaps you heard about it. A lot of people find this interesting. And he was also involved in, all of you heard about, AlphaGo. Also there he contributed. Nal, it's your floor.
Thanks, Seb. Hello. I want to tell you about I want to tell you about a simple and powerful way of generating all kinds of data. This is work with all my great colleagues, Aaron, Karen, Lasse, Sander, Ivo, Oriol, Alex, and Corey. So a standard approach for both modeling a distribution, learning a distribution in sequences, and to generate these kind of sequences, is to factorize this distribution P of X into a chain of small conditional factors. And these factors are conditional distributions over the parts that make the sequence. And this has been standard for many years in sequence modeling, is what underlies LSTMs and RNN sequence models for text and so on. Now, we can take this equation and trivially generalize it to multidimensional data. We can generalize it to images where the factorization then involves two products, one across the rows, one across the columns of the image. There's also channels, but let's not worry about that at the moment. We can also factorize across other tensors, like interesting tensors such as videos. Now, this factorization is trivial and simple in its mathematical form, but a question arises, what kind of architectures do we need to be able to model these efficiently, quickly, and actually obtain powerful samples and also powerful results? So recently, we had these questions with a number of my colleagues, and over the past year, we worked on a few models, on the Pixel RNN, Pixel CNN model for images, on its extension to videos, and on the Byton model, which is a different architecture for text prediction, and on the Wavent model for audio generation. And in this talk, I would like to highlight a few of these things. I will not go through all of that. I will just highlight a few of the important aspects of these models. And it's a unifying family of generative models. We, of course, rely on a lot of great prior work, and here's a subset of it. So let me begin with an architecture for sequence prediction. So when we think about RNNs and we think about very long sequences, if the sequence is very long, we have to process it in a serial fashion, right? And of course, we can cut the backpropagation through time and make it shorter and so on. But this serial aspect is core to RNNs, and it's very hard to get around it. Now, because we were interested in very long sequences, in long sentences made of characters, or long sequences in the audio waveform made of lots of samples, 16,000 samples per second. Because of the reason, we were pressed to find a parallelizable architecture, something that could at least during training, that could be parallelized across the entire sequence. So of course, we thought about convolutional networks. But convolutional networks have a slow-growing receptive field unless one does something to them, and this something is introduce a dilation factor in its kernels. This has been done for image segmentation before. We did this for one-dimensional sequences. And so what happens, we use these convolutions, which are masked or causal in the sense that they see only the past and don't see the future. We apply it to our one-dimensional sequence. We apply it layer by layer, and we double the dilation factor in each of these layers. What results from this is an exponentially growing receptive field, exponential in the numbers of layers of the network. And so with just a small number, dozens of layers, or 24, 36, in principle, one can get receptive fields of a billion tokens or so on. So besides this advantage, we can actually inspect how forward and backward signals flow in these architectures. And we can compare it with the normal flow in deep RNNs. What we see is that because of this structure, with just a few steps, we can the signals can reach all these steps in the past. And that is without making pooling assumptions or combining the input signals or other things like this. So we naturally get a kind of memory which in RNNs it's at every step it's limited in the sense that it has to remember everything from the past that is going to be useful for the future. Whereas in these convolutional networks, the higher we go in the stack, the fewer things these things need to remember, and they can specialize for the prediction at that time step. So these are nice ideas, but we have to benchmark it properly. And one of the common benchmarks for where LSTMs are kings to this day, and all kinds of refined, interesting, powerful models are the state of the art, is the Wikipedia text state character language modeling benchmark. And we see that our simple approach was able to reach the best results on this benchmark currently. And the results coming out basically once a week. We also applied, of course, this architecture to the text-to-speech task and for audio generation. And we also obtained very good results, and this was done by colleagues Aaron and Sander. So this is our one-dimensional fast architecture for sequence modeling. I want to describe one modification of this architecture, which in a very simple way also allows us to model machine translation, the generation of these machine translation sequences. This modification is almost trivial, it's very simple. If we had the bytecode decoder on top, now we take a bytecode encoder, which is just as before, but now we do not mask the convolutions. We let the receptive field grow just as fast, and we simply stack the encoder on top of the decoder. This actually generalizes the sequence-to-sequence LSTM in the sense that it sidesteps the bottleneck and actually preserves the complete resolution of the signal. The way we make this applicable to variable length outputs is simply by letting the decoder, the top orange part, choose its own end of sentence token. We can train in such a way that basically if it needs to go beyond the source representation, just does that. If it wants to be shorter, it can stop earlier. So not only we go around the bottleneck problem in these encoder-decoder RNNs, we also go around the quadratic factor in the normal machine translation models that use attentional pooling. So this simple architecture is actually linear time. How does it work? We have some recent results, and on this data set it works pretty well. And also it works comparably well to world-level LSTMs on other benchmarks too. Another really interesting feature and a really compelling aspect of the attentional pooling mechanisms is that they learn these very nice maps of how source and target words align. Well, these kind of architectures can learn these sensitivities automatically, implicitly inside the data. Now, I've spoken about one-dimensional sequences, and now I want to show you how we generalize these frameworks, basically the same architectures, but into multiple dimensions. Another very important problem in generative modeling, of course, is the modeling of video data. And so that means that once you have a sequence of past frames, we want to produce the future frames. We actually do not want to produce a single trajectory in general. We actually want to produce multiple trajectories because the world has this stochasticity in it. So we have to model these multiple trajectories. A single one could be sufficient for some applications, but in general, we want to have a generic model that can produce distributions across multiple possible futures. Again, the product rule, the dependency chain rule, tells us how to factorize this joint likelihood over all these pixels in the tensor data for videos into a sequence of conditional probabilities. And we have to be careful so that when we predict each single pixel in each frame, we condition it on both the spatial dependencies within that frame, that means the rows and columns within the frame, as well as the temporal dependencies in the past. And we have to do this properly across the three channels. A great innovation to do this properly and do this efficiently is the idea of mass convolution, which appears in pixel RNNs and pixel CNNs. And basically, just like before, we're masking the convolutions in the BiteNet and WaveNet models to not see the future. Now we mask the convolutions in order to not see the bottom and right of our image. And we generate from top, we generate simply, we choose one direction, which is generate from the top left to the bottom right corner. So this is how the architecture of video pixel nets works. In orange, we see the networks that encode the context, each one frame at a time. And in this, and the one important thing about these CNN encoders is that they have to be resolution preserving. Just like before, we were preserving the resolution of the encoding in the translation model, and we're losing the least information. Here, in the same way, we preserve information for each pixel in the encoders. And what this allows us is to channel all the representational power of the network for the prediction of each pixel in the decoders. And the decoders are pixel CNN decoders. And the main difference is that in the decoders we have mass convolutions, and in the decoders we don't have mass convolutions, we have normal convolutions. Similarly here, we can use dilation in the encoders for very large images if you want to grow receptive fields fast with very few layers. A core idea that we developed when we were working on these models is a discretization of continuous values, continuous valued variables. This discretization is crucial both in pixel RNNs, pixel CNNs, in video pixel nets, and in WaveNet. A simple way to do this, is in the case of pixels, is just treat each pixel intensity as its own category and obtain this highly arbitrarily multimodal distributions using a simple softmax. This is for each pixel. This is important for robust learning and actually yields better results, quantifiably better results in likelihoods. So we took the video pixel nets and we decided to benchmark them. It's important to benchmark generative models, and one of these benchmarks is moving MNIST. It's a simple benchmark where you have 10 frames of MNIST digits moving and bouncing between walls. It was introduced by Srivastava et al. In 2015. What we see is that the VPN obtains 87.6 value for the density of for the entropy of the density. And this actually is basically just a hair above of the actual lower bound, which is in this case is non-zero and can be computed very easily. The results in likelihoods, or in this case in the density, often and basically always correlate with the quality of the sample. This is true in basically everything I've told you so far. And this is why when we optimize these networks, we always try to push down the likelihood as much as we can, and we actually get qualitatively improved samples. What we see here in the left side, we see the 10 history frames. The right side, we see the 10 future frames. The bottom is the ground truth. The top is the baseline model, which doesn't have spatial dependencies, and we see blurring artifacts. The middle row, on the other hand, is the production of VPN. And there is no blurring because it captures the spatial dependencies. Sometimes there is slight deformation, and that is the 1.3 nats that we're missing. This happens again on another sample, in this case, 9 and 4s. Similarly here. All kinds of artifacts have occurred generally with all kinds of video prediction models. We can also let this roll and just basically see how they generate. Again, on the left, we have the model without spatial dependencies, and on the right, we have the VPN. And we see the blurring effects of the model without spatial dependencies and the non-blurring effects of VPN. We can also try a different data set. This is the robotic pushing data set. This is available online. What is nice about here is that we each of these frames shows four continuation, to the left in the case of the model without spatial dependencies, the right in the case of VPN, four continuation which start from the same history. We have a history of two frames and we predict 18 frames. And we see that because it's probabilistic, because it captures stochasticity, we have a plausible variation of continuations for the robotic arm moving around. Also, we predict about 18 frames. In other cases, we predicted more frames as well in other data sets, and this actually works pretty well for VPN. Another example of the variability of data set, here is just more motions of this kind. These are uniform samples, and there's no cherry picking, actually. So this is it. This was my talk. So we described, so pixel byte wavenets are a unifying framework for generating data. And they have similar architectural principles, and they work extremely well across different modalities. So let's use them. Let's push the likelihoods as up as much as possible. Thanks.
Null, thanks a lot. Are there any questions?
I know your wave network really well, and with other kind of things that you talk about here. One very specific question here is that you talk about this quantization, the need to have quantization, that actually dramatically increases the size, the number of output numbers. Why can you simply do the regression just to get continuous numbers out? So the need for quantization, that's my question.
Yeah. So doing, well, it's possible to use continuous distributions as well. For example, a recent paper by Tim Salimans and others in OpenAI, they still discretize the values, but they actually use a mixture of logistics, and you can see the details, and that is perfectly fine. In the case of pixels, we only have 256 outputs, so actually using the softmax is extremely robust and it's just as fast, so there's no problem in speed there. The bottleneck would be actually in the network, would not be in the sampling procedure. If your space is very large, other continuous distributions are good.
Yeah. So for WaveNet, the papers said that without quantization, nothing works.
Right.
I don't understand why.
So, well, the problem is if you use an L2 loss or something like this, right, you do not capture these. You basically have this blurring effect, right, that you have in other models, right? And the same happens for audio data, right? So you can use other distributions there probably as well, continuous distribution in the case of awareness as well probably, but the discretization helps a lot, right, to make sure that we don't blur stuff, right? Yeah, we don't take the mean, but we actually choose the modes. Yeah.
Auto-regressive models like these ones seem to give really nice results, but their kind of inherently sequential nature seems to make them much slower to sample from than some of these alternative latent variable approaches like variational autoencoders or GANs. Mm-hmm. So do you have any thoughts about how you could push these kinds of models to get closer to kind of real-time generation?
So the theoretical bound is obviously fast. If you can sample, you know, if we properly implement it, we can probably get very fast sampling speeds, right? So it's a question of course, there will always be a bound. If we want to generate 4K video, it's going to be probably pretty hard. But I think we can do much more than what we're doing right now, most likely. Yeah.
Yep. You say that the lower bound is pretty good to compute. And I just read the formula, actually. But this lower bound is actually made over the assumption of a 3D model. I mean, 2D model plus time, right? So basically, this is the lower bound for a model such as the one you're presenting here. However, other type of model could actually have an even lower bound than that, couldn't it?
That's false. That's the lower. That's the theoretical lower bound. If you could see, if you had an oracle about what is coming next. And that is because of the way that the loss is formulated. It's actually a simple fact about the loss. You can see this in the paper.
Yeah. I have a question. So yeah? My question is about learning representations. Like in images are naturally not a sequential data, right? So there's a two-dimensional topology to them. Mm-hmm. So do you think you can use this? I mean, at the end of the day, if the goal is learning representations, is this somewhere in the hidden under the hood of this, you know, this powerful generative model?
So your question is whether the lack of a two-dimensional topology is a problem or?
Problem not in image generation. I mean, the results are very impressive, but in learning representations.
You mean for learning a single latent representation for the image?
Not a single. I mean, at the end, you want to learn about images, right?
Yeah.
That's the goal.
Well, yeah, sure. So there's a lot of latent representations in these models.
Yeah, I understand.
And they're also extremely sensitive to conditioning. So if you condition to a single vector, one thing we've done in our conditional pixel CNN paper. You can actually learn smaller representations if you want a single vector representation. Then you can do the usual averaging of the latents and things like this to get nice effects. But there's a lot of hidden representations in these models, so it's a matter of using them properly, I suppose. But yeah.
So have you looked at it? So in terms of what are those latent variables are? If you
no, we have not. You should do it.
Yeah, I have another question for you over there.
Yeah.
In the tutorial on Monday, Goodfellow stressed that GANs maybe don't reach the optimal likelihood value, but that images generated are visually very appealing. What is your opinion on this?
I think I answered the question during the talk. No, so yeah, so I think GANs are great, a really great model, and I think that they are the least understood generative model at the moment. And as more analysis comes in, we understand better exactly what these models are capturing. And of course, there's a sense in which they capture just one or just a small number of modes of the actual distribution, and that's why the images look good, but only in that particular mode. But this analysis is preliminary, but there are results in the direction. We actually care about capturing entire natural distribution, and I think this is actually really important, unless you want to do simpler things. But if you want to do planning and things like this, capturing the whole distribution, I think it's important.
Thanks.
Okay. I have a quick question, actually. So. Did you try also using it for like classifications? I only see like generation here, but did you try this on like say ImageNet or something like that to see how well it classifies?
So we have not done this.
Okay.
And it's similar to the question of the other guy, you should do it.
Okay.
You guys can work together.
Okay.
So very quick.
Last question.
Yeah, so for GAN style of generative model, one can actually put condition on there as the labels to allow the model to do classification or semi-supervised learning, etc. I wonder whether in your generative models discussed here, whether that allows you to do, you know, maybe sequential classification if you condition on the labels.
I see. So you want to invert? Oh yes. So yeah, we have not tried this, but you can classify. By using base rule, basically, you can invert the. Is that what you mean?
Yes.
Or okay, yeah. We have not done this. Sure, you can do this. Yeah.
Okay.
Of course, likelihood values are they're very sensitive, so it's going to be hard. It's going to be harder than the discriminative model, almost certainly, but it can be tried.
Okay. Great. Thank you.
Nal, thanks again. Let's thank the speaker.
Okay, so now we're going to begin the panel discussion, of which I'm the moderator. I think the topic is supposed to be the future of machines that learn algorithms or something along those lines. It's going to be quite open plan, I think. Maybe we'll talk. You know, we'll go around each other, around this group talking for a little while, and then throw it open to questions from the audience afterwards. So I think one thing that came up over and over again in the talks today was this issue of meta-learning or learning how to learn, and that's obviously like a very core idea. So would all the panelists like to say something about that? I know you want to start, Jürgen, go on.
No.
Don't be shy.
So this learning to learn is really exciting, isn't it? And there, the idea is really that you open the learning algorithm itself to inspection, such that it can inspect itself and then also modify itself. And then interesting questions appear, such as how can you make sure that you are not overwriting important parts of the code that is doing the self-inspection and so on. And 30 years ago, my very first work ever in this field was my diploma thesis, which was about evolving, in 1987, evolving better evolution strategies and better ways of evolving, better ways of evolving, better evolution strategies. And I had this thing which is called meta-evolution based on genetic programming that was recursively applied to itself. But in many ways it was too complicated, and what we see today is much more practical stuff, which is applying basic program search techniques to this problem of finding programs that are good at finding better programs. And I think that has a lot of future, to the extent that we are really using concepts from optimal program search, which are optimal in an asymptotic sense, and we can use these properties of these programs that are optimal in or program search methods that are optimal in an asymptotic sense to come up with self-improvers, recursive self-improvers that are also better in and maybe optimal in a non-asymptotic sense, in a very practical sense, and I see a lot of future in that. Now I talk too long, now you say something.
Okay, thank you, Jürgen. So, I mean, meta-learning, obviously the potential of meta-learning is extremely large. Learning to learn, we've seen a few directions of trying to do that. I'd say that right now the situation is that we've got a number of interesting toy applications, but we haven't yet built a truly impressive meta-learning system. And the challenge is really to figure out all the difficult details of how to do that. One particular weakness of the meta-learning approaches that at least I'm familiar with and have some experience with is that you assume that your problems come from a certain distribution, and then your test problems must come from the same distribution. If you are systematically different, then it's not going to work. So fixing this problem, I think, would be important.
Yeah, so my perspective on meta-learning is a little different because I come from the neural evolution perspective. And this is what I was talking about earlier today. I didn't think of it at the time as meta-learning, but obviously fits this idea very well. And there are two reasons why it's a little different. First one is that there's a separation of the kinds of learning mechanisms, that we have lower level learning mechanism, which is typically this gradient based deep learning. And then at the higher level, you have the evolution. In the lower level, we have a training set. We know the problem we're trying to solve. In a higher level, we're trying to figure out what the best network is to do it. And that's an open-ended problem. We don't know what we're looking for. We hope that evolution can find it for us. And therefore, there's a nice synergy of the two different kinds of learning mechanisms. And another reason why I think it's natural is that there's an analogy to biology. We have two different time scales. There's an evolutionary time scale in which organisms are created or species are created, and then individual time scale, where individuals learn during their lifetime. I think there's a very powerful synergy in nature, and maybe that's something we can capture in this artificial approach as well.
Yeah, so actually I learned a lot by listening to a few talks about meta-learning. So it's a really fascinating area. So one of the things that I was thinking about during listening to various talks about meta-learning was that a lot of learning algorithms that we know...
Your microphone, either you...
Here?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So a lot of algorithms that we are using so far are not very biological plausible. For example, you know, backpropagation is very hard to justify. It's really biological justified. So I think using meta-learning will have the potential of having the algorithm that actually eventually learn the learning so that, such as eliminating backpropagation, using backpropagation or something else, to gradually evolve the learning to be something that is really more biological feasible. That's the kind of things I will really hope to see.
Okay, so this word, meta-learning, a very powerful word. It reminds me of the words love or creativity. Those are real and important things, but they exist in different forms at different levels. And it's important to understand the different forms. Much of the meta-learning discussed here today reminds me a lot of some very important work done by Ford Motor people, Lee Feldkamp and Poskorius, on what they called multi-stream learning. And there was even a paper in the WCNN, 1995, when a little paper by Feldkamp where he said a recurrent neural network which learns to predict anything. And he had a database of 12 totally different time series from totally different dynamic systems, and he showed that if used a time-lag recurrent network trained by backpropagation, it would develop the ability to quickly catch on which of the 12 possibilities it was in. It was very similar to a lot of what we've heard here today. So the principles that Ford developed for its multi-streaming work, that's one very important route in the past. Now, what about these other concepts of meta-learning, like optimization, trying to find the optimal universal learning design? I think that is a very important direction. But in order to define what we mean by the optimal universal learning system, we really have to think about our prior assumptions. If you don't assume anything a priori, or if you just assume digital Turing structure, you wind up with very little capability. In truth, it reminds me of an old story. Forgive me, old men tell old stories. I met Deng Li in 1990 in a big workshop in Canada, where Bernie Woodrow talked about his truck backer-upper, and I talked about backpropagation through time and other things. And a guy in the audience got up and he said, look, all these methods have problems with local minima. I have a universal learning machine which is guaranteed to converge to the universal optimum. It was a stochastic method to explore everything. He asked, what do you think about it? Bernie Woodrow scratched his head. He said, well, actually, my wife is a local minimum. But you know, you can live with a local minimum. You know, you have a finite amount of time in life. That was his answer. My answer was, consider the application problem Bernie has just described. Your method is guaranteed to find the right global optimum only after you bounce around the world a dozen times and explore every woman on Earth. And you've got to consider the time factor. The story goes on, it's entertaining, but the bottom line is that in the real world, we kind of do the best we can. The mechanisms to overcome local minima are an important part of our brain. It's almost like fighting germs. There are levels and levels of systems that make you less and less vulnerable to local minima. But there's no absolute guarantee in the real world. Humans will never learn to play a perfect game of chess. That's life. We just do the best we can.
I'm very fascinated about learning to learn since 15 years, 20 years. I think we will see cool stuff coming out. One problem I see is we have two small systems. We have to build much larger systems to really boost learning to learn. And we are working on neural networks which are much larger, where you don't need weight normalization, you don't need layer normalization, you don't need all these normalization things. We're working on big networks which automatically reach a state where they learn best without any external adjustments, without any fine-tuning. So networks try to get in states where they learn best. And then learning to learn becomes possible in a large scale without fine-tuning, tweaking, and we're working there and we have the first results. It's fantastic. Not this tweaking, this normalization. Think about batch normalization. It's not the way. So networks should themselves go into states where they learn best, and then you can build big AI systems, then you can really implement learning to learn in a very efficient way, and we will see very, very cool stuff in the near future.
Go on.
Can I say one more thing? I agree with a lot of the things that have been said, especially what Paul said about what exactly is it, this meta-learning thing. In the 90s, there was a book, Learning to Learn, and if you look at the different chapters, see most of that isn't really the holy grail of learning to learn. It's just transfer learning. So you have one problem here, and you get some result with your standard run-of-the-mill learning algorithm, maybe backpropagation, and then you have another data set over there, and another training example over there, and then, of course, the network over time learns more about different kinds of data sets and is faster in picking up new data and learns better. And all of this has, in my point of view, very little to do with true learning to learn. This is just transfer learning, which is happening all the time. True learning to learn means you have to look at the entire set of computable algorithms, including the computable learning algorithms, and you have to make your meta-learning system such that it can change itself without any limits, except the limitations of computability, which have been expressed from 1931 by Gödel. And so a true meta-learner doesn't have any limits besides those. And that will allow a true self, recursive self-improvement, as opposed to just, you know, variations of transfer learning.
But do you think that transfer learning can stimulate meta-learning in the sense that, you know, a system can learn, you know, in response to the data, it can modify the way in which it learns?
Yeah, that is certainly true. So you want to get a lot of different experience from the world, from all kinds of data sets that you can collect from the world. Your entire life of experiences can be used to become a better performer. Absolutely, yes.
Because in general, I think there's often a blurred line between, as you say, meta-learning and transfer learning, and then just between transfer learning and learning, full stop. I mean, in a sense, all learning has to be transfer learning, in the sense that at least you want to transfer to some unseen example. And I think you do get, if you just train like a single neural network on a lot of different data types, you do get this effect of rapid switching between them. And it's interesting you talk about this old paper. I've seen similar effects myself, where you get this very rapid, you know, the networks can learn to very rapidly adapt to whichever, you know, new kind of regime they've been put into.
Yeah.
Does anyone from the panel has any more they'd like to say? If not, maybe we could take some questions from the audience on the subject of meta-learning.
I don't have a question, but I wanted to answer a question to the statement of Paul Werber. So we're very familiar with the work of Elkham. In fact, I used to talk to him a lot during my PhD because I was training neural networks with Kalman filters in those days, UKF, CKFs, particle filters, and so on. And so that work then also relates to Rich Sutton's, since we're going to start bringing all the literature. Rich Sutton's has an algorithm K1, which is also an extended type of Kalman filter. And if you try to learn the hyperparameters and so on, you can think of this as essentially as hierarchical Bayesian inference for a dynamical system. And he used a diagonal, and he tried to learn the diagonal by gradient descent to make the training efficient. And that was taken by other folks and called SMD. It's also related to Gauss-Newton type algorithms. And I think also Seb, we have... Actually, many, many people, when we published this paper, contacted us saying, we have done that. But what happens is people tend to do it in a restricted setting and or did not actually have any experiments to test the validity of their claims. And so there is a really wide literature. So we ended up having to have an extra related work section in the appendix. So for people who are into learning to learn, I recommend you look at the appendix of our paper where we sort of expand on this. But we are perfectly aware of the idea of learning an algorithm being related to those fixed parameter recurrent networks or some dynamic parameters. And we're also very aware of the issues of scale. No one has demonstrated scale. I think recently several works have demonstrated scale to 30,000 parameter networks. That's unprecedented. And that's possible because we use gradients. We're learning an algorithm that uses gradients, histories of gradients. It's a way of learning alternatives to, say, what Nesterov does and so on. We're learning ways of escaping saddle points. I think we still don't understand it theoretically well, but we definitely are using gradients.
Actually, yeah, there are some things about that Ford work related to what you've said that are worth mentioning twice. in training time lag recurrent networks.
Move your hand up.
The Ford people generally used time lag recurrent nets adapted by backpropagation through time, but they fed those derivatives into an extended common filtering learning scheme. And it's a funny paradox because they used extended common filtering as part of how they train the recurrent networks to get them to learn faster. But at the same time, they were an engineering company. They compared the use of recurrent neural networks versus the use of common filtering in the normal way, where people would use common filtering to estimate the state of a nonlinear process like an engine. There was a magnificent paper they did for a Yale workshop, which is very obscure. I posted it on my webpage. I don't know if it's easy to find. You can find it on Daniil Prokhorov's webpage. But it was fantastic and important work, even though it was not widely publicized. They had real data from a real engine. This is not imaginary work. Real data, real engines from Ford, millions of data points. And they looked at the power of state estimation using common filters, using particle filters, and using time lag recurrent networks. They found that the particle filters and the time lag recurrent nets performed about equally in accuracy, and both were much better than extended common filters. On the other hand, they found the time lag recurrent networks were much cheaper to run, much faster. So at that point, they just continued to use time lag recurrent nets. Another aspect of that is the common filter calculations use more computer space for the learning than you have in the operation. This is an important aspect of learning. The information content you need to keep moving ahead in real time is usually much greater than the information content of what you're actually learning. And that's like metagenetics. When evolution learns to learn, you may find out that only 4% of your DNA is used for actual decisions, and the rest may be part of this learning to learn apparatus, which requires much more information than the thing you're trying to learn.
Hi. So when mathematicians generalize from real numbers to complex numbers, there was this beautiful property that you don't need to go any further, you don't need to go deeper. So is there anything particularly elegant about learning to learn that says that we don't need to go, you know, learning to learn, and so on? This question is like directed to people who are in support of learning to learn, such as Ilya.
So there's an answer to that.
There's another answer.
And what you want to do, what you really want to do, you want to have a provably optimal way of modifying yourself such that you are becoming a better reinforcement learner. And there's such a thing, and it's the Gödel machine, published in 2003. And it's optimal in a certain sense because what it does, among all these self-modifications which lead to this chain of meta-learning and meta-meta-learning and meta-meta-meta-learning and so on, it's going to pick the one that is the most efficient given the limited abilities that it's starting with. And it has a proof that, for that, and that's the reason why at some point it decides, okay, now I'm going to rewrite myself like this, including a rewrite of the proof searcher who gives me that result, maybe. I'm going to rewrite myself like this because I have a proof that this is the best way of rewriting myself. Okay, so yes, so at least in theory, there's an answer. Whether it's practical, that's a different thing.
But wasn't there a retraction for that paper? I mean, there were problems with this construction because it didn't generalize depending on the language that was used for the for computing the norm or the cost.
I don't think there was any retraction. I should have known about that.
2015, 2014, I don't remember.
Actually, this question about learning to learn is very much like the question of recurrence. People talk about how many layers do you need in a network? One, two, three, four, infinite. But if you have a recurrent network, two layers of a very broad recurrent network already embody 100-level layer processing because the recurrence takes care of it. So if learning to learn is done in a recurrent fashion, then you only need the two layers.
I have immediately support this. If you have a recurrent network, it's all about credit assignment. If you solve the credit assignment problem, all the hierarchy collapses immediately. No matter what problem you have or what problem of problems you have, if you can assign what is driving your output, what is influencing your output, what's related to your output, then you can do all these hierarchies. And therefore, these hierarchies do not appear at all.
Yeah. So that's just one comment here. In terms of similarity and difference between learning to learn versus transfer learning, as discussed earlier. Now, for transfer learning, I have done a lot of work on transfer learning. For example, our team actually in voice recognition, it's a very easy to do transfer learning. For example, if you do a good job on English, you know, voice recognition, it's very easy to transfer to Chinese recognition. As a matter of, you can actually combine them. So once you do one well, and then you can do the other well. So the way I understand learning to learn is that it's not just using the same mechanism to go from one to another. For example, sharing certain hidden layers, you can do other, that's transfer learning or master task learning. Rather, you know, from human perspective, if you actually learn how to do certain tasks well, then when you are trying to do different tasks, then you actually learn the mechanism of doing the first task of learning. And then you exploit the new mechanism that you learned in the previous task to, you know, to benefit for the other task. And I think that's the way I understood that learning to learn is the essence of this. You learn the mechanism.
Maybe we should move on with some more questions here.
Okay, so I have a question, but first a correction from my side. It wasn't the Gödel machine, it was the Eichsel that was retracted a couple of years ago. But anyway, my question is about how fruitful do you think it is to separate learning and meta-learning? Because lots of what we've been seeing is, in a sense, more related to having an adaptive learning rate, or several thousands of adaptive learning rates in case you have an LSTM that does the learning for you. And Susan Holmes in her keynote said there's no metadata, there's only data, and perhaps there's no meta-learning, so there's only learning.
I actually, in a sense, I would say that I agree, or at least I think it's not necessarily a good idea to draw a sharp line between learning and meta-learning. I think, you know, if you're learning well, then you're learning something profound, and if you're learning something profound, then it's some sort of meta-learning, some sort of adaptation.
However, if you...
Jürgen disagrees. Sure, yeah. He's got an optimal way of doing it, that's the difference.
But I think one important point is if you have transfer learning, you are also getting better. You can have one-shot learning of new data images, for example. If you have trained your deep neural network on 1,000 image sets of a certain kind, you will learn new things quickly by just, you know, training the topmost layer, retraining that, and use all the previously learned feature detectors. That's transfer learning. But using the same,
move your hand up.
But then you are always using the same algorithm, which is still backpropagation, to be applied to these weights in a certain fashion. And now it works better than before because the network has learned a lot about images from all kinds of different data sets. So that is transfer learning, but it's not meta learning in the sense that the algorithm itself, backpropagation in that case, is replaced by something that is better. No, it's just a side effect of this previous data. So I would be less inclined to call that meta-learning. To me, that's advantages of additional data that you get over time, which help the original training algorithm, which you do not change through meta-learning, which help that to perform better on new data.
Could we make a statement?
This is still a credit assignment only. That's still all credit assignment.
I mean, I think you could make a general statement. There's always something that you hold fixed, and there's something that you adapt. There's something that you sort of choose ahead of time you're going to stick with, like the backpropagation algorithm, like your network architecture, something like that. And that's called learning, and then it becomes meta-learning when you start adapting the thing that you were previously holding fixed. But I think it's always there's always a shifting goalpost there.
Well, there's also the time scale difference, that some learning happens actually within a time slice of a higher level learning algorithm. Then it's natural to separate those two.
More questions.
So I wanted to point out that there's two very different things, which I think I'm hearing from Ilya and what I'm hearing from Jürgen. And so that being that Jürgen is suggesting that we need to have an infinitely complex that can learn anything, and this is optimal. Whereas Ilya is pointing out that in the learning to do RL, that we're actually restricting ourselves to a smaller class of models, which are generated by a prior. And I think that the difference that's getting washed over is the amount of data it takes to learn stuff. So I wonder if you two could say why you disagree there, or whether there's not really a disagreement.
So I don't think there is a disagreement per se. I think it's a matter of tactics. So basically, I mean, like the way I see things, the goal is to build a system that could learn really well. If you look at feedforward neural networks, they don't, we don't say that they meta-learn. You need to have some kind of something recurrent, perhaps you could see these things as doing meta-learning. Basically, the point is you want to have a system which is doing something useful, something impressive, that clearly meta-learns, and you can get it there any way you want. You definitely need to make some assumptions about the environments you're solving, because otherwise, that's the whole point. So yeah, what do you think?
I think that sounds good, and maybe we switch to another topic.
Maybe a couple more questions on meta-learning, and then we'll switch to something else.
Okay.
People have been waiting.
All right, so I'm interested in the relationship between meta-learning and, I guess, brain-inspired learning. I mean, one of the other major trends that I guess we've seen through the conference is, using neuroscience and inspiration of how the brain works to develop learning algorithms. Now, I guess it's sort of a controversial way of putting it, and I guess you can respond to that, but I mean, humans are really bad at learning to learn in some ways, because, I mean, for example, humans can never remember 100 characters like that, right? I mean, you can show them 100 characters for like a second and say, remember this, even though it's easy for computers, but, humans, you can give them incentives all you want, but they'll never learn this. So would you say that humans are good at this learning to learn stuff? And is there an inherent conflict with, between becoming better at learning to learn and becoming more brain-inspired in designing algorithms?
It doesn't sound like a conflict to me.
So I'll just make one comment about a specific example, and that is, so I am 90% sure that if you train people to memorize long sequence of numbers, they can become pretty good at it by using chunking. They become well practiced at identifying patterns and storing high level patterns. So people can get quite a bit better at that.
Yeah, actually, I can think of another strange example. I remember an investment fund which discovered with a proper use of neural nets with 100 neurons, it could outperform the market by 7% per month. They were doing great. And somebody said, wait a minute, if an artificial neural network with 100 neurons can beat the stock market, how come real humans with 100 billion neurons cannot do better? And the brief answer is, the computer pays attention. And if we learn to pay attention, we could be superhuman if we learn how to pay attention.
I think let's just have one more meta-learning question, and then we'll
it's not meta-learning.
Oh, okay. We'll have have another question then.
Okay, so
a meta question.
Coming into the science, and this is actually my first time at NIPS, I noticed that there are quite a few fights or like arguments about where specific ideas come from, and it's like no. I really don't want to judge anyone here. Like I haven't read all the publications, so I don't know who was first. But I'm a little bit concerned that we are like going in a bad direction with that, with like focusing on fighting instead of working together. And then the other thing is that it's also like hard to like get some of those old papers, because if I have to pay 40 euros to a publisher to actually read the paper because it only in the last 5 years got easy to get like new papers because they are on archive or NIPS proceeding are easily accessible. So it's hard to get the paper, and then I cannot get the data probably, so I cannot reproduce the results. And I don't think that we are like going very bad direction there, but I'm a little bit concerned, and I would like to know what your opinions are, like how we can do better there. And
I think one of your problems can be quite easily resolved. You just email the author and ask for the paper. The other one is...
That's not a very fast way. I mean, that takes a day probably.
That's true.
If it's fast, and it probably doesn't work for some because not everyone replies to a student asking for a paper.
But I think the other problem is going to be much more difficult to resolve.
So I'm asking you. You are the experienced researchers and the great minds. So, have you ideas how we can do better?
I imagine this happens in every academic field. I don't know. I think it naturally becomes kind of competitive. And I think what's happened in recent years, deep learning's exploded. The field has become much more crowded, and now everything feels like a race. Every idea you have, it feels like someone else is racing to get there first. And then, even when you do get there, someone will say that they got there 20 years ago. And so it No offense, Jürgen. it does feel like it's getting kind of silly, but it would be better just to stop fighting so much about who did what and just get on with the research.
But of course, maybe get your applause there. but of course, so in the hard sciences like mathematics and physics, you would never have a discussion like that, huh? Because it's totally clear in mathematics you have a new theorem, but you used maybe the proof technique of somebody else, and it's totally clear you have to mention this guy, otherwise you are stepping outside the field, you are becoming an outsider or something. So in these traditional sciences, this whole process is totally codified, and everybody knows exactly what to do. And then in this field, which is growing so rapidly, there are lots of guys who are not really from the hard sciences, such as physics and mathematics, where they're the standard, but they are from, you know, philosophy or psychology partially, and sometimes you might get the feeling that they have different standards there. And of course, to the extent that we want to be a hard science, we just have to adopt the standards of hard sciences. So I think there cannot even be a debate about that. No.
In truth, my job at NSF included a lot of fun of hard technologies. And I really don't think that they have achieved peace and perfection in that area any more than we have. It's very difficult. I don't think we've spent a lot of time fighting here. We haven't spent a whole lot of time on, you know, I did mention one old story, but I can promise you that when neural nets were considered heresy, now it was fair game to do anything you want against neural nets. There are lots of stories. And I think the mature way is not to dwell on those stories, but to try to move ahead. And I think we've mostly been doing that here. But I would say that the problems exist with innovation and patents. The problems exist in the hard sciences. A few years ago, there were people who said the United States is totally out of whack in the international system. We give patent preference to the people who actually invented something, unlike all the rest of the world, which had lower patent rates, lower invention, and would always give the patents to the big corporation that filed later after the invention. And they decided to harmonize. And in the United States, there are people who have advanced engine designs that could change the world, and they will not even patent them, because now that we've harmonized with a nice orderly system, it's a nice orderly system which discourages innovators. And when we adopt the easy path, we have to ask, does the easy path eliminate the innovation, which is what we really need? So these are not simple questions. And as I say, I've seen it in physics too.
I mean, there are classical cases of that, even going back to this most famous quarrel of them all between Newton and Leibniz, of course, 300 years ago. And we don't even want to go into that. But you point at a very important thing, patents and everything that is related to industry and company, suddenly you have more incentives to do something than in pure mathematics, where it's just about reputation and where everybody is following the rules, you know, because this is not really commercially relevant. And to the extent that something becomes commercially relevant, suddenly guys who don't care for reputation or whatever, but just for the success of their company and for the money, they have a real different reward system there, which leads to very different results than in the end. And to the extent that we allow this field to be taken over by company interests, there's a problem, yeah.
Let's have some more, or to add to Jürgen's point, at the same time, it should be noted that even though there are many companies that are involved in machine learning research, I would say that it's fair to say that all companies are, and all the researchers in those companies are extremely good citizens of the community. And I think it's really unusual that we have a field where the industry participation is so community-driven. And I think it's a good thing, and let's keep it as long as possible.
So I wanted to make a clarification for the, sorry.
Nando asked.
There was a statement about humans not doing learning to learn, and that's actually not factually correct. There's a paper by Harlow from 1949, cited 1,976 times, according to Scholar, that is proving that macaques do learning to learn over the period of their attention. Not even over the, we're not talking about evolutionary scales here, but we're talking about multiple simple scales. Behavior psychologists like Evans back in the 30s also did this. Learning to learn is a really very broad, diverse field. We're drawing inspiration from many fields, and I think this is part of the reason of not knowing about some of the citations. But no, it's definitely the case that animals do learning to learn, and it's an important piece of the puzzle to understand intelligence, and we need to work on it.
Next question.
It's Mike Moser here.
Oh.
I'm biting my tongue to respond to some of the earlier comments, but the question I want to ask you is, I'm so impressed with the large systems people are building, the ambitious systems people are building, but as Nando described it, these are still toy systems, and everyone appreciates you have to scale up. And it's going to take a while to get there. But wouldn't it be really useful? I want to open a paper and look at a graph that shows me, as a function of the problem size, how does training time or number of training examples grow? I want to see that scaling function. Even if you can't get out to the point where you're solving, you know, real-world, large-scale AI problems, I want to know, is that thing linear? Is it exponential? Do people try to do that?
Sometimes people, I mean, present that kind of information. I mean, often the limiting factor is just having to run so many experiments. I mean, a lot of the problem in deep learning now is that each individual network and each individual experiment is huge. So then if you have to collect statistics over many different scales, it gets tricky. But
well, you repeat it three times, so it takes you a week to put it on archive instead of 2 days.
Yeah.
Thanks.
So expanding on that a little bit, this an approach that's being proposed, say Holger Hoos and Marcus Hitter and others, that these systems have indeed become so complex that it's impossible to program it anymore, and we have to do it automatically. So they've developed methods like hyperparameter optimization and indeed evolution and Bayesian parameter optimization for that purpose. So we can't handle the complexity anymore ourselves, so we have to put it into hands on machines.
Hi. Sorry, I missed the beginning, so I don't know if this has been covered or if we're on some certain topic that this doesn't fit into, but I'm curious what you guys all think about the relationship between continual learning and meta-learning, and in particular, if meta-learning is sort of the right approach to continual learning, or if there's some other interesting avenues for that, and also how you would distinguish between these experimentally in practice.
I mean, continual learning sounds more like transfer learning. You mean continual learning in the sense of like lifelong learning?
Lifelong learning, yes.
that somewhere in the audience is Mark Ring, pioneer of continual learning, and he would probably argue, but Mark, correct me if I'm wrong, that what you have been doing for a long time is a type of a transfer learning which goes beyond what's traditional in the sense that you are adding new skills on top of the other skills and then basically operating in program space to a certain extent as opposed to just having a feed-forward network which learns to deal with new image sets more quickly after being trained on a whole bunch of previous image sets. Well, I don't see any reaction. Oh, there he is. Okay.
Yeah, I'm right here. Yeah. So I would say continual learning is somewhere in the middle. So it's definitely it's somewhere beyond transfer learning. It's definitely different from transfer learning. It's about building up skills and knowledge over the course of a
closer to the microphone.
Starting from zero, starting from time equals zero to time equals infinity, learning more skills and learning more knowledge, and using what's learned now as in the ingredients for what's learned next. I would say that's not the same as meta-learning in the sense that you mean it, Jürgen, and as you have used it, which is really about revising every aspect of the algorithm that that the agent that determines the agent's behavior, which I think is a larger, more ambitious image of how to do learning. So I would say these are definitely different. But again, continual learning is certainly different from lifelong learning or transfer learning, which is based on learning one task and then learning another task and starting over again for every task, which is also not realistic description of what we, for example, as humans do.
So I think we've got about 20 minutes left, is that right? So maybe we should try a distinctly different topic for a little while. I think one thing that came up in a few of the talks is this issue of what we should be, of kind of benchmarking, you know, what we should be doing to test out these new capabilities of our network. So we're in the frontiers of new recurrent neural networks, new architectures that can maybe they can meta learn, or they have memory that they can manipulate. They have all of these things, and a recurring problem, something that we run into a lot at DeepMind, is that we do all these things and we test them out, and we find that either they can solve the same problems as the algorithms we had before, or there are problems that nothing seems to be able to solve. It's just too difficult. And it's hard to find this middle ground where you can really differentiate between these new, even when you know that the architecture, the algorithm is doing something new and interesting, it's hard to find the data, it's hard to find the task that highlights that difference. So it's an issue of data sets. Like, where do we need to go now with new data? Maybe you could start this off, Ilya, because you were talking about the universe.
Yeah.
OpenAI universe.
So, like the general philosophy about benchmarks. So there are two philosophical things about benchmarks, which I think are about a good benchmark, which I think are important. The first is that you want a benchmark where if you achieve it, if you solve it, then you know you're doing something that you were definitely not doing before. You want to be at a point where if you can solve it, then it means that you have a system which is objectively smarter than previous systems. And you also want to make it possible to hill climb. And then specifically with respect to universe, we try to design it so you have this great variety of lots of difficult tasks. So that if you can do well on this, then you must have rapid learning abilities, and you must have the ability, and you must have substantial world knowledge. And so the hope there is that if you to do well there, you need to have real successful meta learning. Now, we don't have it yet. It's pretty clear. So more research is needed. But I mean, in general, a good task, like, that's one of the main drivers of research. I mean, if you only work on supervised learning data sets, you're only going to have methods for supervised learning. So if there's a good task, it's hard. We iterate a lot. We get to a good point. Progress will happen.
So I think we have actually a great opportunity to define such tasks. Now, this community involves a lot of people from industry, and a lot of the good research is done in industry, and a lot of times it's motivated by problems that need to be solved. for building a product or doing something that actually works in the real world. And it's also, usually those challenges are in that sweet spot. They are not too hard. People want them solved. You're already doing, but not doing a good job. So if indeed the community stays involved, the industry stays involved in this community, we might be able to find such problems from the real world, and they would be in that range.
I think that's a very important point, because you can always devise these synthetic problems that match your algorithm, but it's really more interesting to have real-world benchmarks. And I think for a long time, machine learning had lots of those from all of these large-scale supervised classification data sets, but now that's kind of exhausted, and we need a new territory to move into.
Yeah. So this is a very good question. So let me use our Microsoft research sort of some tasks that we have been doing now to illustrate some of the views that I have. So we have a very active research on this machine reading comprehension task. And we have gone through all the previous sort of tasks, over the last 2 years, starting with Facebook Barbie task. And then, of course, the children book, and then the CNN, and there's a whole bunch of tasks going over there. And at the end, the secret there really is not to give comprehension. If you see all these solutions that we're having so far, really it's not the understanding of the text. Rather, you can view all these tasks, memory network, or maybe even including neural Turing machines. All these architecture simply give you very, very good feature at the end. At the end, at the top, you still have to use softmax, using labels, try to guess what they are. And the tasks have been defined in such a way that the answer has to come from part of the passage that's given to you, right? And that's not realistic. So we realized that maybe about 1 year ago, we thought that, well, we really should use the realistic understanding task to do. So so our team, actually, within Microsoft, the group of people that I've been working with recently, we just released this database called the MACO, Microsoft Machine Comprehension Task. We actually collected close to, the aim is the 1 million, so the question answers, which do not have the kind of limitation. And also the task is driven, is extracted, the data is extracted from the real thing, search engine, real life problem. And the answer do not have to be limited to be something that is already in the test, in the passage that I given. And so I think although the solution to those are a little bit evasive, we are working very hard on those. And to solve those problems, it does require some good understanding. If you don't, then you don't even know what kind of answers are. So it's not going to be the fixed number of answers that you are going to get from there. And that's one part. And the other part that I'm actually personally very much passionate about is that when we talk about comprehension, understanding, it's not just a matter of getting get answer. You really have to interpret in terms of symbolic form so that, since we're dealing with customers for any realistic machine learning systems, very often customer would demand that, tell me why that happens. We cannot just say that, wow, look at this neural net weight, the matrix I'm giving you. Customer will get very upset, right? So we actually encounter a lot of applications that we do have this kind of demand. Now to do that, the neural computation somehow has to get connected to symbolic form, especially in terms of use, the interface to the users. Human just don't read matrices, okay, as our customers. Our machine learning people read matrices. We understand what tensor looks like. But when you go back to the customers, they read in terms of symbolic form. They read natural language. So the answer has to be back in terms of symbolic form. And I think we need to design database to serve all these realistic purposes. So another way we are actually thinking about our tasks. I have been pushing that very hard, but people in our Microsoft sometimes ignore me all the time. Because it's kind of two different things. In order to have real understanding of reading, it's not just a matter of you do one thing, right? You put the answer there, you propose, so the test set will be you give answer there, you want to have, you put questions there, you get answer back. Right? So even if the answer doesn't have limited form in terms of the choice of the selections, the way we have been doing now, it also has to be able to simulate human that probably get into this multitask transfer learning and learn to learn. So we believe that in order to have the real understanding of the text you're reading, we need to design the task in such a way that, you know, you give the label, I can give the answer right. But in addition, after you do this, you also need to have another task so that the system can give the answer even without giving any data for the other task. For example, as a human, if I understand, if I want to do translation from English to Chinese, I normally understand what I hear before I actually translate. If I just do, you know, word by word, whatever sort of symbolic mapping or neural mapping, you know, whatever, and that is not going to translate well, right? So that's the way we normally think about, you know, when we design the database. We need to have sort of the realistic goal, the real life kind of scenario, keeping in mind, you know, very much in sync of your.
So then the question becomes, how can we design problems that force the networks to communicate what we're doing, what they're doing? How can we make that quantitative?
Yeah, so that would require that we design neural net architecture, or probably we need to integrate the symbolic, you know, reasoning together with the neural net in order to go. Just purely doing neural net, it's very hard to do that. Mm. Yeah, that's my view.
If we ask, where should we be going? We do have to remember the larger social context. As a hypothetical question, supposing we had an answer to your scaling problem in space and in time and the local minimum, supposing we had a way to apply the power of quantum computing to make it even more powerful, to build computers that could outsmart the human brain. I think we can, but if we know how to do it, should we tell the militaries of all the world how to do it? What do we really think the consequences would really be in this real world we live in? We have to be really careful about things like that. So when we think about constructive new directions for development, there are a couple of positive examples I can think of that are not quite so scary. Okay? Even without scaling to a million variables, there are things we can do with prediction and control of just 10 to 100 nonlinear variables. We could do it optimally, in a more realistic way, not with random search, but with more rational priors, and apply it in certain contexts. The two examples I'm most intrigued by of some totally new way out application areas, they're not everything. One application area is in a kind of market design. Like the electric power market gives an example of an Internet of Things which can be radically different from the central system. There are people who want to build one big intelligent system to control everybody and everything on Earth. And that is a real danger. That is a current, pressing, real danger right now. But alternatively, we can embed intelligence into market-type systems which respond to human beings and under the control of them. And maybe the individual units are not smart, or they're smart only to the level I would call vector intelligence. Good 10 to 100 variables, but in a system that integrates human preferences with what you're doing on the computer. So that's one direction. I think the electric power industry has started to move that way, but there's a lot of room to improve it. There is an urgent need to improve the security of it. We have some needs for security at the foundation of all these internet systems, which are really, really urgent. It's not intelligent systems, but God, if we don't get this IT infrastructure on a solider basis, even more solid than what electric utility has, we are in real trouble. This is an urgent problem. It's not our field, but it's necessary for us and for other people. Another example I think is very interesting comes, believe it or not, a field called space solar power. There are people who think you can bring electricity down to Earth from space at a very low cost if only you could do effective robotic assembly of thousands of little modules. And they know how to design the modules. And they tend to say, oh, well, we know how to control robots to move around a million modules, and it makes me wonder what they know about real robots and how easy this isn't. But there's a concept called teleautonomy, developed by a guy named Greg Baden in the mining industry. It's a way of structuring a system where you have, in his case, maybe 10 or 100 humans controlling 10 times as many robots. And you automate individual tasks at the robot level with a high level of intelligence, just enough so that the human can control them. And they reduce the cognitive burden on the human by doing the dirty small bits of work, and the humans coordinate the big picture and remain in charge. And it doesn't really require words or symbolism. It doesn't require building an artificial Einstein. If I knew how to build an artificial Einstein, I don't think I would do it. I would try to understand it, but I wouldn't want to build it. And that's tricky. How do we learn to understand it without building it? But that's what we're challenged to do.
My comment to benchmark data, I going back to something like self-driving cars. I think I agree to the other speakers. We have to go out to the world to check our systems, but in a controlled environment. I'm telling the car companies we need kindergarten for cars. And cars have to make driver license. Not the driver, but the cars have to make driver license in a controlled environment. And if they can do this, they can drive. The same for systems. Put it on real data, put it in real world, but under controlled environment. So not everything breaks down. And if they prove good, you can release them perhaps. But we have to put them to the real world, because otherwise it's only theory.
Do we have some questions?
Yeah, I've got maybe two, but let's go for the first one. I was wondering, I learned a lot about meta-learning this afternoon. Thank you for making this workshop available for all of us at NIPS. One of the things that I would like to know from the practitioners of all these different architectures is, you've run a lot of different cases, a lot of different architectures, and you have even had some meta-learning build new architectures. Have there been surprises, that is, architectures that you were not expecting showing up on your computations and that essentially were close to state of the art? That was the question.
I lost the thread there.
The thread is pretty simple. Yeah. In doing the meta-learning, you're learning different architectures. Have there been architectures that you were not expecting? A counterintuitive type of search?
Perhaps I comment on this. It's not the architectures, but the learning system I observed was faster than everything else on this world, but I couldn't understand it. I don't know what this thing did, but it was so fast, very greedy, yes, not precise at the end, but it was a learning algorithms I cannot understand. But it's better at the beginning than everything else which exists.
And was it published?
That?
Was it published? Which paper are you referring to?
It is published.
Okay. I think it's
look up Learning to Learn 2001 Hochreiter et al.
It's almost 9 o'clock now, so I think we should wrap up. Maybe just to take one more question from the audience there.
Oh geez. Well, I don't know if we can. This is a good one to end on, but. So I know in convolutional neural networks, I've saw a result was that the hidden layer often corresponded to edges, and that was sort of like an intuitive understanding of the first layer. I'm wondering if there's any intuitive understanding for the first layer of a recurrent neural network.
Well, generally, with a recurrent network, I mean, the first layer is also the second layer is the third layer. I mean, it's a little bit less, it's less clear cut. I mean, if you have a deep network with multiple layers stacked up, then you might get some subdivision of labor going on.
I guess in I'm wondering if there is an analogy where kind of higher layers are made up of those edges. I'm wondering if there's any intuition to the weights of a recurrent neural network.
One thing I have seen, so in speech recognition with a stacked LSTM network, so several LSTMs on top of each other all going through time, there was a tendency as you went higher up the hierarchy for things to change more slowly. So at the low level it moved quite quickly with the signal, at the higher level it was changing slowly along with the classification. So I think there was something similar going on to what you see in ConvNets.
So I want to add to this. There is a paper by Silo and Barak, which analyzes the activations of recurrent nets on small problems in terms of fixed points. There are pretty cool figures over there that provide the kind of intuition that you're looking for.
Maybe just Thank one you. More question over here.
I was wondering, is Sorry. It possible to use the machines to discover more efficient algorithms? For example, see whether we can discover polynomial time algorithms for the NP complete problem.
That sounds tricky.
So I should. Even though it's probably hard to do in the general case, in this ICLR there has been a paper that showed how to train a recurrent neural network to do two-dimensional traveling salesman person, and they were able to beat a bunch of well-known heuristics. So you can't do it in a general case, but some specific things are definitely possible. Unfortunately, I don't remember the authors.
Yeah, but one should add that, of course, in traveling salesman problems, there is a long tradition of huge TSP solvers, much bigger than the one that you just mentioned, and they have different types of machine learning, like, for example, artificial ants and stuff like that, which usually they don't find the optimal solution, but there's a whole field about finding epsilon closed solutions, and they are really the state of the art in all kinds of problems of this complicated and complex kind. I don't think that neural networks necessarily are the best approach towards achieving better performance.
So there's a lot of work on that in the evolutionary computation community. In particular, Stephanie Forrest did work on automatic, not only finding bugs in programs, but fixing them automatically. And the bigger picture, I mentioned Holger Hoos, his point is that because the programs have become so complex, they are very hard to write for people. And humans should just write the outline, and then we should use machines to optimize the code and fill in the details. And he has a bunch of examples of that, and you might want to look him up.
Just following up on that. So together with Holger Hoos, I worked on SAT solving and AI planning, etc. And we've been regularly winning SAT competitions using machine learning in order to figure out which solver to use on which instance and which parameters to use on which instance. Also in AI planning, there's this learning to plan track, and the very similar methods are being used. And this has been going on also for decades by now, but it's really something that is pretty much using the same techniques that are now being used in learning to learn, in a different parameter space. So there's no gradients there, and I think we can learn a lot from each other. So that's great.
Okay, so I think we should wrap up the panel session now. So could we thank the speakers, the panel?